Hello, and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, May 7th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 944 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we speak with writer and political analyst Mohammed Shahada, who discusses the latest efforts by Israel, the U.S., and the so-called Board of Peace to impose a new formula on the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Later on in the program, John will cover week 9 of the war in South Lebanon and update the latest on the Strait of Hormuz. And Asa will update us on the Filton 6 retrial verdict and the State of Palestine Actions campaign against Israeli arms firm Elbit in the UK. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. In Gaza, Israel killed 10 Palestinians, including children, and injured many others in a series of airstrikes on Wednesday, amidst intensifying attacks against Palestinian police and security personnel in an effort to degrade civil governance inside Gaza. The Wafa news agency reported that Israeli aircraft targeted the Daraj neighborhood of Gaza City, a group of people in Jabalia, and a civilian vehicle in Khan Yunis, which killed a police colonel who was a senior figure in the Palestinian Interior Ministry. 17 people were also wounded in that strike, according to Al Jazeera. Reporter Nahed Hajjaj filmed relatives grieving over the bodies of 3 Palestinians, including a child, who were killed in an Israeli strike targeting a group of civilians in the Zaytun neighborhood in eastern Gaza City. Iyad Amawi, an NGO coordinator in Gaza, told Dropsite News that at least 3 Palestinians also died of wounds they sustained in previous airstrikes in Gaza City and in northern Gaza. Israeli drones dropped bombs on partially destroyed residential buildings in Gaza City, and Israeli artillery was reported around Bereij refugee camp in central Gaza, Dropsite added. On Tuesday, a 15-year-old child, Mohammed Sahwil, was killed in an Israeli strike on a police station in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood in Gaza City. Reporter Nahed Hajjaj captured video of Sahwil's relatives collapsing in grief around his body. Palestinian police said the strike targeted the Sheikh Radwan police station northwest of Gaza City, killing the child and injuring several officers and personnel, Dropsite News stated. A separate Israeli attack on a police security point earlier in the day killed one person and injured another, according to medical sources. On Monday, May 4th, journalist Saeed Hezbollah captured video of a young boy in shock over the loss of his brother, who was killed in an Israeli strike in the Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Hezbollah says, quote, "A child stands silently staring at the face of his brother who was killed today in the Zaytun neighborhood, unable to believe that the loss has become real. These are the heavy days children in Gaza are living through, where childhood is intertwined with sorrow." As of Wednesday, Israel has killed approximately 840 Palestinians and injured more than 2,300 in Gaza since the fraudulent ceasefire was declared last October. Meanwhile, despite the thousands of ceasefire violations Israel has committed without consequence by the so-called international community, and despite adherence to the terms by the Palestinian resistance factions, Israeli Army Radio stated this past week that Israel is preparing for a possible resumption of full-scale war on Gaza. This comes as the Israeli military announced it had expanded its theft of Palestinian land inside Gaza to nearly 60% of the total enclave. One of many violations of the so-called ceasefire agreement is Israel's ongoing restrictions on humanitarian aid, including nutritious food, as well as medical supplies and medications. According to the World Food Program, hunger is still prevalent across Gaza, with one in five families reporting only being able to eat one meal a day. The agency says that cooking gas shortages force nearly 7 in every 10 families to burn waste, alongside other unsafe means of cooking. This is an increase of 13% compared with last month. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated this week that more than 6,600 Palestinians in Gaza need prosthetic and rehabilitation care, including thousands newly amputated since October 2023, yet only 8 prosthetic technicians are available to respond. The UN's partners say that 1 in 5 amputees is a child. But with severe shortages of specialists and restricted entry of prosthetic materials, it could take 5 years or more to meet today's needs, assuming no further amputations occur. Gaza currently has the largest population of child amputees in modern history. International prosthetic technicians are urgently needed, as is the expansion of workshop capacity and the unimpeded entry of prosthetic materials, which remain restricted by the Israeli authorities, the UN said. The Electronic Intifada's contributor Malik Hijazi reported this week that more than half of medications in Gaza are out of stock, according to data from the General Directorate of Pharmacy at the Ministry of Health in Gaza. Of 622 essential items, 312 were unavailable as of March 2026. Hijazi writes that, quote, the shortage of medicines in Gaza is rooted in the blockade Israel imposed in Gaza in 2007. But the genocidal war that began in October 2023 pushed an already fragile system into operational collapse. The ceasefire that is not a ceasefire agreement that came into effect in October 2025 has brought no meaningful relief. Only 4,999 trucks entered Gaza out of 23,400 planned under the agreement, amounting to roughly 21% of the intended volume. And the empty shelves in pharmacies up and down Gaza bear this out. In March, the World Health Organization's regional director, Hanan Balki, warned that stocks of essential medicines, trauma supplies, and surgical consumables are critically low, and fuel shortages continue to limit hospital operations in Gaza. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders reported that it has been unable to bring any supplies into Gaza since January 1st, 2026. Israel has denied Medical Aid for Palestinians, or MAP, access for aid since March 2025, as has UNRWA, the UN's Agency for Palestine Refugees. For more, read Malik Hijazi's recent report for the Electronic Intifada, Medicine Shortages Amid Siege Leave People in Peril. Approximately 180 international activists who set sail for Gaza as part of the Global Samud Flotilla, intending to break the Israeli siege and deliver humanitarian aid, were intercepted by Israeli naval forces in international waters off the Greek coast on April 30th. Most of the activists were detained and taken to Crete, but two of them, Saif Aboukeshek, a Palestinian citizen of Spain, and Tiago Avila, a Brazilian citizen, have been in Israeli detention now for a week. Adala, a Palestinian legal and civil rights organization that is representing the activists, said on Wednesday that an Israeli court rejected an appeal against their detention and instead extended their detention until Sunday, May 10th. Aboukeshek and Avila's lawyers argued before the Israeli district court that the court, quote, failed to address the state's fundamental lack of legal authority to carry out an arrest, which was effectively an abduction in international waters. A lawful arrest under these circumstances would require formal extradition. Since there is no lawful authority to arrest, every subsequent day of detention is illegal. Adala added that, quote, this is especially egregious given that the activists were abducted from an Italian-flagged vessel, placing them under Italian jurisdiction. The operation is a clear violation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which stipulates that only the flag state may order the arrest or detention of a ship, even for purposes of investigation. The Italian government has already condemned Israel's move as illegal. Both activists have been on hunger strike since their abduction by Israeli forces, according to the Global Samud Flotilla Organization. On Wednesday, Saif Aboukeshek escalated his protest to a dry hunger strike, refusing both food and water. Adala's legal team reports that the activists have been subjected to systematic psychological torture and explicit threats to the lives of their families. On Tuesday, Brazil's president Lula da Silva demanded that both activists be immediately released, and he admonished Israel's violations of international law. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces invaded the city of Nablus on May 3rd and opened fire into a crowded shopping area, firing tear gas and live ammunition. Naif Samaro, a 26-year-old man, was shot in the head and killed while his wife was in labor at a nearby hospital. Four others were injured, including two children, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, and dozens of people suffered from tear gas inhalation, with 10 of them requiring hospitalization. Naif Samaro's body was brought to the hospital where his wife was giving birth to their son, according to the health ministry. Meanwhile, Avi Bluth, the head of the Israeli military's central command in the West Bank, admitted that the army is killing Palestinians at levels, quote, not seen since 1967, according to the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz. Bluth made the remarks in a closed forum, where he also expressed pride in his policy of relaxing the rules of engagement for allowing troops to open fire at Palestinians. Veteran journalist Ali Samoudi was released from a year in Israeli administrative detention inside the Nakab prison. In a testimony Samoudi gave upon his release, he said that he lost half of his body weight, quote, under brutal detention conditions. The prisons, he added, quote, are a true hell, a graveyard for the living. Israeli forces raided and ransacked Ali Samoudi's home on April 29, 2025, then interrogated and detained him. The military's administrative detention order cited Samoudi's, quote, presence posing a danger to the security of the region as justification for his detention. CNN, which worked with Samoudi over the years, stated at the time that the Israeli military acknowledged that it did not have sufficient evidence to substantiate terrorism funding allegations it leveled against Samoudi. But the military court sentenced him anyway. Samoudi, who has reported from Jenin for decades and contributed to local and international outlets, was working alongside Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh when she was assassinated by an Israeli sniper nearly 4 years ago. He was also shot in the shoulder during that attack, and the Israeli soldier who killed her has never been held to account. And in East Jerusalem, Israel notified dozens of Palestinians that their shops and businesses will be demolished in the town of Al-Azariya as part of a plan to expand a nearby massive settlement colony. Anadolu News Agency reported that Israeli authorities warned that the facilities and their contents would be demolished if owners failed to abandon their businesses. Palestinian officials said appeals against the demolition orders have been submitted to an Israeli court, with hearings expected later this month. The Jerusalem governorate and municipal authorities linked the demolitions to the E1 settlement colony project, which aims to connect the Male Adumim settlement block with East Jerusalem. Palestinian officials warned that the plan would effectively divide the occupied West Bank into northern and southern sections and isolate Palestinian communities. The municipal authorities also said the project includes a separate road infrastructure system involving tunnels and segregated roads for Palestinians and Israeli occupiers. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, our contributor Rokaya Shamsuddin reports that since the early morning hours on Thursday, there has been a wave of Israeli airstrikes in the south, targeting residential neighborhoods, civilian infrastructure, and emergency responders. She posted on social media today that, quote, in Nabatiya, Israeli warplanes struck the Maslach neighborhood, completely destroying a building, while additional raids hit the outskirts of Nabatiya al-Faqwa. Further attacks targeted the outskirts of Duer and the town of Toul. In Habush, an Israeli strike targeted a van at dawn, with preliminary reports confirming at least two people killed. Near Sheikh Raghib Harb Hospital in Toul, Israeli forces carried out a double-tap attack. An initial drone strike drew paramedics and rescue workers from the Health Association and the Islamic Health Organization to the scene before Israeli warplanes intentionally bombed the area again, wounding multiple civil defense personnel and obstructing rescue operations. Israel also bombed Beirut on Wednesday, while Israeli airstrikes and drone attacks killed at least 16 people and wounded more than 20, including paramedics in the south, in the latest violations of the so-called ceasefire. Rokaya will have a full report for us shortly, which we'll post separately, and we'll have much more on the situation in Lebanon coming up in John's Resistance Report. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight When I Leave My House, I Fear I May Never See My Family Again by Lubna Ahmad Abu Sitta, writing from Gaza. Lubna writes about the process she goes through to meet her graduate advisor in Deir al-Balah at Al-Aqsa University's temporary headquarters to submit her master's thesis plan and wanting to look elegant for her meeting. She writes, quote, what someone outside of Gaza might take for granted, putting on a nice outfit and looking neat, is not taken for granted here. We wash clothes by hand. We carry jugs of water for this task and save money for soap. Washing clothes by hand takes hours. Then to iron, we must have a battery charged and ready. At our house in Khan Yunis, where I am from and where I've lived for all my life, I put on my best clothing, a light beige coat and a checkered scarf, and I set off for Deir al-Balah. The moment I step onto Al-Bahar Street, I am hit by reality. The streets of Gaza are a shock to the senses. The asphalt of the road is gone. The pavement of a sidewalk is not pavement. It is dirt and debris, a mix of shards of concrete, trash, and other various bits of rubble. Mountains of rubble are on either side of the former street. I play hopscotch among the debris, carefully picking where to place my feet to avoid sinking into puddles. It is a desperate struggle to keep my outfit clean, to maintain the idea of myself that I had built up while getting dressed. Then there is the fear. Since the beginning of the war, the mere thought of going out alone has terrified me. The prospect of being killed by an Israeli attack and nobody finding my body for days. When I hear the drones, I imagine they are watching the person right next to me, waiting to strike. It is a recurring nightmare that if I go north to Gaza City, Israel will again cut off the north from the south, and I will be trapped there, away from my family. I wait for a car to pick me up. I see what has now become a common sight, a trailer, or akala, hitched behind a car, transporting people who must grip the edges of the trailer to not fall out. I watch as their bodies jerk and jolt over the shock of the bumps in the road. Every car that passes is a mechanical miracle, dilapidated, dilapidated, broken, and running by sheer luck. Most of Gaza's cars have been destroyed by Israeli attacks, and it's more common to see cars burned up, discarded, or stacked than running on the roads. The smell in the air is cooking oil, which is mixed with gasoline to get a little more mileage in a car, and I choke a little as I breathe it in. After a full hour of waiting amidst the swirls of dust, I feel the elegance from before slip away. I finally manage to get into the back seat of a packed Skoda car that is also hauling a trailer with even more passengers. Next to me is a woman in her 60s, whose 13-year-old granddaughter has moved onto her lap to make room for me. On the other side of her is a medical student whispering into her phone, I will send the reports as soon as I reach the hospital. I'm still on the road. Suddenly, the car stops and a woman in her 40s, her face drenched in sweat and anxiety, pleads, "Let me sit with you. My mother is waiting for me at the hospital." We somehow managed to squeeze her into the back seat. So now five of us are crammed in there. I look out the window behind her and see hundreds of people on the road waiting for a car with looks of despair on their faces. I pull my thesis work out of my bag and I try to read through it. My master's degree is in geography, and my thesis is about map-making skills among Gaza's youth. I find it hard to focus, though, and I close my eyes for the rest of the journey. I had left home at 8 a.m., and it is nearing noon when I arrive in Deir al-Balah. I take my wet wipes out of my bag and clean my shoes and scarf and try to regain composure. But after a four-hour trip, it is difficult. As I try to find my professor, I think of Dr. Wissam Issa, the head of the geography department at Al-Aqsa University. He was martyred in December 2023. I miss Dr. Wissam. He would have been the one to guide me through my thesis. I also think of my friend Shahid, another geography master's student in my class. She was martyred with her family a year and a half ago. The meeting with my advisor is short, about an hour. We discuss the challenges ahead of us, studying geography and technology with limited resources and a lack of reliable access to the internet or even electricity. Around 2 p.m., I begin the journey back to Khan Yunis to make sure I can get back before sunset. Every step I take toward earning this degree, I now see as a tribute to those we have lost. Those are excerpts from When I Leave My House, I Fear I May Never See My Family Again by Lubna Ahmed Abu Sitta, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. Usually we focus on acts of reclamation inside Gaza, but today we're going to Michigan, where history and African studies professor Derek Peterson delivered a commencement speech honoring some of the student body's current and historical figures, including those who have fought for the rights of Palestinians against Israel's genocide and stood up to the university's repressive administration. After Peterson's speech, the university's president, Domenico Grasso, publicly apologized for Peterson's remarks, claiming they were, quote, hurtful and insensitive to many members of our community. Two candidates for the university's Board of Regents called for the university to censure and punish Peterson for his speech, and right-wing politicians, including Senator Rick Scott and Nikki Haley, threatened the university over Peterson's remarks. On May 4th, Peterson wrote on his Twitter X account that, quote, after much prevarication, the University of Michigan has now made the video of the 2026 commencement available. My talk can be seen below. Congratulations to all of those who graduated last weekend. Go out there and make good trouble. Here's a clip of Professor Derek Peterson's commencement speech where he talked about honoring the students who have changed the university's history.
Sing for the students of the Black Action Movement, whose members demanded a curriculum that would reflect the experience and identity of Black people in this country. Sing for the pro-Palestinian student activists. Who have, over these past 2 years, opened our hearts to the injustice and inhumanity of Israel's war in Gaza. The greatness of this institution does not only rest on the shoulders and on the accomplishments of our student athletes, who deserve all the congratulations we can offer them. But the greatness of this university rests also on the courage and the conviction of student activists who have pushed this university down the path toward justice. It is to them that we can rightly sing, "Hail to the victors valiant, hail to the conquering heroes, hail to Michigan, the leaders and the best." Congratulations to all of you who are graduating today. Go Blue.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. It's good to see you. Thank you for that report. And we're going to be talking about so much more about what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah.
The dire situation that deliberately kept that way, as well as Lebanon, as you said in John's report. But that speech by Professor Patterson was very inspiring. Of course, the response from the University of Michigan, as cowardly and craven as you would expect from a great American liberal institution. And I just wanted to point that, you know, now May is graduation season across the United States. So it's also university cowardice and surrender to Zionism season. Yep. And there's another prominent example of this right now I just wanted to point to. Rutgers University School of Engineering canceled the commencement address by one of its alumni, Rami El-Ghandour, who is a very distinguished alumnus of Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey. And he's also the producer of the Voice of Hind Rajab, the film.
Right.
And here, I'm just going to read a sentence from a report from Common Dreams. They say, Al-Ghandour said the engineering school's dean, Alberto Quitinho, had informed him that he was no longer scheduled to give the commencement address after a few students told the administration they would not attend the graduation in protest of Al-Ghandour's online advocacy for Palestinian rights. So another despicable and cowardly example of a major American university caving in to the feelings of genocidal Zionists and canceling free speech. Just utterly craven and cowardly. And the message, of course, Al-Ghandour made this point in an interview he gave in some of his tweets, is the message that these university presidents and boards are sending by cowering to Israel and its lobby and pro-Israel donors and government officials is, don't speak up, don't stand for anything, keep your head down, stay silent. That's what they want this generation of American students to believe. It's disgusting.
Yeah. And this is not a new phenomenon, of course. This has been status quo for decades now. You know, we've covered this since the beginning of the Electronic Intifada 25 years ago, where students, members of faculty, visiting scholars, lecturers have been repressed, silenced, censured, punished, and slandered because they dare to say that Palestinians are human beings and deserve the right to exist. It's just so. Yes, this is the season of university cowardice and
submission. But it's not working. You know, sorry.
No.
It's not working. I mean, you know, the repression does have some effect, but I mean, as we talked about last week, you know, you and I have been going out and speaking and meeting people.
Yeah.
And the beauty of that is you get to visit campuses and see that students are not deterred by this. They're determined to keep Palestine present as an issue and the complicity of these universities present, because this is not just an academic discussion about something happening halfway around the world. All of these universities more or less have financial, scientific or whatever ties to Israel and to the war industry that they are trying to protect by silencing student voices.
That's right. Yeah, they're more beholden to their donors and their contracts with these biotech and weapons industries than they are to their students and the notion of academic freedom. It is it's so depraved, and we keep seeing this over and over again. I know that in the next coming weeks there will be more incidents like what happened to Derek Peterson and to Rami El-Ghandour and so many others who dare to to defend students' rights to protest their university's complicity in a genocide. So we'll see what happens. But yes, we have so much coming up. We have, of course, John's resistance report, and Asa is going to give us an update on Filton 6 in the UK. Ali, let's go to an interview that we did yesterday with Mohammed Shahada, talking about the current situation on the ground in Gaza and what the US, Israel, and the so-called Board of Peace is trying to do to the Palestinians.
As usual, Mohammed Shahada is full of information that you will not get from anywhere else. This is just a fascinating discussion. I think people are really going to get a lot from it.
Yeah. All right, let's go to that.
You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Nameh, here with my colleague Nora Barros Friedman. 7 months ago, Israel agreed on paper to a ceasefire framework. The Palestinian resistance would ensure the return of all living and dead Israeli prisoners of war and captives. Israel, meanwhile, would stop its genocidal attack on Gaza and the daily massacres that were killing dozens of civilians, pull back its forces, allow large-scale humanitarian aid into Gaza, open the Rafah crossing, and let a Palestinian-run civilian administration begin functioning. The Palestinian resistance factions kept their side of the deal, returning all of the Israelis. But to no one's surprise, Israel violated the agreement. It kills Palestinians in Gaza daily, almost 1,000 since the start of the so-called ceasefire. It is seizing more and more land in Gaza, moving its yellow line further and further to the west. Israel is still bombing Gaza and destroying what is left of the buildings and infrastructure. It's still choking off aid and preventing the entry of mobile homes and shelter materials. And it has blocked members of the so-called National Committee for the administration of Gaza from even entering the territory, let alone starting to manage it. This is not a failed ceasefire. It is one that Israel never implemented. Meanwhile, Washington and the rest of the so-called mediators and much of the media, to the extent that they still even talk about Gaza, shifted the non-compliance and ongoing crimes and aggression. All of this is a far cry from the fanfare around the so-called Board of Peace and the AI-generated images of a shiny future for Gaza that we saw after the ceasefire was agreed. But that doesn't mean that nothing is happening. In fact, the US and Israel have been trying to impose a new formula on the Palestinians, working through Nikolai Mladenov. Mladenov is a former UN official. Now he is the Director General of President Donald Trump's Board of Peace, and he's its so-called high representative for Gaza. Someone who knows more about what is going on behind the scenes is Mohammed Shahada. He is a writer and political analyst from Gaza and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He recently wrote Gaza's Disarmament Trap for 972. Mohammed has also seen two key documents, proposals, or rather demands, sent to the Palestinian resistance factions by Mladenov. Mohammed Shahada joins us now to unpack what has been happening and help us understand how Israel, the United States, and their allies are trying to turn disarmament into a mechanism for permanent Palestinian subjugation. Mohammed, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thanks so much, Ali, for having me. Good to be back.
Good to see you.
Mohammed, in mid-March, there was a meeting between Nikolai Mladenov, the Board of Peace representative, and leaders of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza. You've reported on what happened at that meeting. Based on your sources, tell us what happened and why it's significant.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, Israel never fulfilled its side of the bargain. And if you look at the Trump so-called peace plan, the only item that was ever fulfilled out of the 20 items in there was the item number one, namely the release of all Israeli captives. Not even the release of Palestinian captives in return was ever fulfilled. Israel was supposed to release all children and women. There's still a number of them that are still held in captivity as hostages. So that was number one. Israel never fulfilled its side of the bargain. Number two, Trump's border peace began to unravel. You had countries like Indonesia suspending its participation in the border peace and pulling out of what is so-called the International Stabilization Force as soon as the United States and Israel began their assault on Iran. And number three, you had members of the technocratic committee that was designated and created by Trump over 112 days ago beginning to question the very existence of that committee, a government in exile, a government that's on paper only, and four of them proposed to resign. They submitted their will or their resignation papers, and then they were turned down. So all of it is beginning to unravel, and there was the fear that Israel might use the fog of war in Iran to start to escalate its genocide in Gaza even further. You might recall, as soon as the first shot was fired on Tehran, Israel immediately decreased aid going into Gaza by 80%. They resumed bombing exponentially. They closed the border crossings, all of them, immediately. So there was that fear as well. And mediators tried to move some of the stagnant water in there. So that's why they invited all Palestinian factions to Cairo for negotiations. And unannounced, last minute, the Egyptians told Hamas and other Palestinian factions that Nikolai Mladenov, that, as you mentioned, the Trump high representative for Gaza, it sounds like a colonial term from the Democratic Republic of Congo, they announced that Mladenov was in the room and he was excited to meet them and put a proposal on the table that would move things forward. The meeting that unfolded on that day, mid-March, we're talking here, it was extremely tense. Hamas and other factions are used to meeting Mladenov when he was the UN special coordinator. So that was around the years, I think, 2018 to 2022. And they saw a totally different person from the one that they were used to. Back then, he had sort of a diplomatic tone when he was engaging with them and meeting with Sinwar, Haniyeh, and others face to face. He spoke on behalf of the UN, so he needed to be more objective and neutral. This time, they describe him as an emissary or an envoy of Benjamin Netanyahu. They say he was extremely condescending, immediately put an ultimatum, a clear threat on the table, that if you don't accept my proposal immediately, unconditionally, Israel would get a free hand in Gaza and would resume its military operations, which meant that he put a maximalist, lunatic proposal that is by design intended to get Hamas and other factions to say no to it in order to absolve Israel of all of its responsibilities under the Trump deal and to give Israel a free hand to escalate the violence. That's how they interpreted it. Afterwards, they were supposed to give an answer within a week. Mladenov gave them that exact ultimatum. 1 week, you have to come back to me with an answer. And they said, yes, our answer is this. Israel never fulfilled phase one of the Trump deal. How are you asking us to move to phase two when the first phase was never fulfilled? Get Israel to commit to phase one, implement phase one, and then we're happy to go into phase two and discuss it. He did not like that answer, and he came up with, quote, a bridging proposal. The bridging proposal was just simply dangling a couple of bribes to Hamas and other factions in return for total, absolute submission. Both proposals are premised on the same idea. Become absolutely defenseless, weaponless. Hand over everything you have. Destroy whatever you have that could mount any form of insurgency against Israel. And only after then, 250 days later, Israel would consider withdrawing from some of the parts that it currently occupies, and reconstruction would begin in some of the parts where there's not even the language of decommissioning or disarmament. He says where weapons and military infrastructure has been completely cleansed. It's the language of cleansing.
Let's dig in a little deeper in these documents that lay out these conditions. We've seen these documents. They're both in Arabic. One is titled Steps to Complete the Implementation of President Trump's Comprehensive Plan for Peace in Gaza. And the second is called The Roadmap for the Completion of Trump's Comprehensive Plan for Peace in Gaza. And as you talk about, they mention one authority, one law, one weapon. They remove Hamas and the other factions from governance. They demand total disarmament, even down to rifles and personal weapons. And they create a so-called peace council, a high representative and a national committee. And as you say, they make weapons collection the condition for reconstruction. You know, everything that Israel has obliterated in the last 2.5 years, is now dependent on reconstruction is dependent on surrender and disarmament. And they stretch Israeli withdrawal over phases linked to verification with no time frame. What do you think is most significant in these documents, and what do they tell us about what Israel and the United States are trying to impose on Gaza? Does it have any semblance of reality at all?
So the first thing is basically the significance of those two documents is that they are trying to completely rewrite the Trump plan to Netanyahu's satisfaction in order to render this plan unimplementable, in order to give Israel an absolute free hand to do whatever it wants. The Trump plan was terrible. Every single European official that I've spoken to, Arab official, experts, etc., whether on the record or off the record, have been describing it as catastrophic. Arab leaders, the very mediating countries that brokered this deal, they said that it was neither a framework nor a plan. It was a spectacle, a stunt. It was a political performance. That's the most that they described it as. They saw it as a scam. But nonetheless, they kept telling us it's the only game in town. We can improve the conditions. We can talk to Trump. We can figure something out. We can figure out a middle way. So that was the premise with the 20 points that Trump released. They were initially 21 points. Then Netanyahu went to the White House, sat down with Trump, sat down with Kushner and Witkoff, and spent 6 hours manipulating it into virtual obsolescence. He added a lot of terminology that was supposed to be there as landmines, as explosives or ambushes that would blow up the deal when the time comes, as we're seeing now. The significance of the Mladenov documents is that it makes all of this 1,000 times worse. So Israel was supposed to suspend all military operations. They never did. They bombed Gaza over 1,200 times, killed over, I think, 826 people since the so-called ceasefire began. They were supposed to allow a minimum of 600 humanitarian aid trucks per day. The UN figures would put it at 94 trucks per day. So that is less than a sixth of the amount that was supposed to go in. So basically, it's less than 20%. They were also supposed to allow this government to go into Gaza immediately. They were supposed to allow an international force to go into Gaza immediately. They were supposed to rehabilitate, repair the infrastructure, roads, electricity, water, sewage, and begin the rubble removal and allow 60,000 housing units. Now Mladenov deferred all of those issues as basically the outcome of Hamas and every single other Palestinian faction accepting complete subjugation, surrender, and destruction of everything that they have that might be used as either defensive weaponry or as basic leverage in any future negotiations. He wants all of this gone. And he's very clear. If you accept this premise, total subjugation, total defenselessness, then we can get Israel to commit. This was never the language of the Trump deal, no matter how horrible and catastrophic it was to begin with. So that is the number one significance there. Number two, there is a clear acknowledgement in the second document that the existing security agencies in Gaza are legitimate. So in the second document, Mladenov and the mediators explicitly say that the technocratic government, the new government, if Hamas accepts the disarmament, that government would not replace the existing security infrastructure, security agencies of the Hamas government in Gaza. Instead, they would merge them. They would add troops to them. They would vet the existing police, the existing security agents, and see whoever doesn't fit the vetting, doesn't pass, would either be given a civilian role within the government or a compensation package. This is the clearest admission on record that Israel has been committing a systematic, large-scale crime against humanity by targeting the civil police in Gaza as part and parcel of the genocide. They kept telling us The police is Hamas, 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 Hamas. And now you have Miladinov, the highest authority in the Board of Peace, admitting that the police is a legitimate authority in Gaza that is separate from the armed factions on the ground. You have the third important and significance to those documents is the second document in the annex. It explicitly mentions all the areas, the items that Israel never fulfilled, which is an implicit acknowledgement that Israel has been violating this ceasefire repeatedly. So that is in terms of the significance of these. It's also significant in its malevolence. So the whole premise of decommissioning or disarmament was to create what is called one law, one vote, one legal system, one police, one weapon, one authority. But in the Miladinov proposal, it creates two. Instead of putting these weapons, one law, one authority, one weapon, under an elected Palestinian government, they put it under INCAG, the Technocratic Committee, which in turn means that the weapons in Gaza would be under the authority of Miladinov and by extension the Board of Peace. So the true sovereign in the occupied territory would be Donald Trump, nobody else. You would not have any Palestinian authority that governs the enclave and has a monopoly on power. It's Trump that would have this, the authority to fire and hire direct people to launch a special operation to use violence against Palestinians. All of it is in the hands of Trump. So that's why it was catastrophic.
So in effect, they want to create a parallel or a copy of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza. In other words, it has a Palestinian face, but it's operating on behalf of Israel and or the United States, which is essentially the same thing in this context. Now,
they're trying to create something much worse. The Palestinian Authority still has a little bit of wiggle room. You might recognize some people within the PA who've been active, vocal. You have Ambassador Hossam Zomlot, others that have been speaking up in the media, at least. What they are doing with INCAG is that every INCAG commissioner has a designated babysitter, quite literally. European officials have told me no INCAG commissioner is allowed to travel or to meet with any European or foreign diplomat without permission from Miladinov or the U.S. They are not given any authority to take any decision without Miladinov or the U.S. or Israel giving them the green light to begin with. So it's basically the Israeli plan for the Palestinian Authority in the future. We try it in Gaza as a demo. They made it clear to Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries that this technocratic committee is merely a pilot project. Once it works in Gaza, it would be replicated to the West Bank.
Yeah. And just to remind people, NCAG is the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, which is supposedly this Palestinian-led committee that will take some governing responsibility in Gaza, but as you point out, has not been allowed to do any of that. And it's headed nominally by a Palestinian engineer called Ali Shaath, a former deputy minister in the Palestinian Authority. But none of them have been allowed to enter Gaza, as you point out. Now, Mohammed, in your reporting, you have pointed out that there seems to be a crucial difference between the term disarmament and the term decommissioning. Disarmament means stripping the Palestinian resistance of all weapons, down to rifles and even personal weapons, while Israel, of course, continues to occupy Gaza, doesn't give up any of its weapons, doesn't commit to any kind of timetable for withdrawal. On the other hand, decommissioning is something much narrower. This is a term that comes from the Northern Ireland peace process. And it was seen as a sort of a preliminary step to disarmament, not a unilateral surrender. Explain the distinction. What is disarmament? What is decommissioning? And why do these terms have any relevance in the context of Gaza that we're discussing now?
Absolutely. So with the decommissioning versus disarmament, the original Trump plan, the 20-point plan that Netanyahu then edited very heavily 6 hours with Witkoff and Kushner, it spoke of decommissioning only. And it drew a distinction between Hamas's offensive weapons versus defensive weapons. Offensive is rockets that could reach Israeli kibbutzim. defensive or any weaponry that could be used against the IDF inside Gaza, the Israeli army inside Gaza, to maintain an insurgency. So basically, the whole Trump proposal was premised on the idea that you don't have to surrender, you don't have to capitulate. That's the original proposal. And it's not Trump's idea. It's basically some smart person added it into Tony Blair's papers. It ended up on Trump's desk. He thought decommissioning sounded fancier than this armament, used it without knowing what it's about. But Bashar al-Bahbah, the sort of liaison between the Trump administration and Hamas, he's an American-Palestinian businessman slash activist that ran a campaign of Arabs for Trump and has been the liaison between the White House and Hamas for some months, building up the ceasefire negotiations. So basically, Bashar said that the White House explained to him what they meant, that any weapon that is capable of killing five people or more upon detonation would be considered offensive weaponry. So it's mainly the rockets, which have been largely depleted. There's not a lot of them. Hamas is not using them. They basically have been abiding by the ceasefire, zero violations from the Gaza side. So that idea there is that those rockets would be either locked up in warehouses or they would be handed over to a Palestinian government, an elected Palestinian, legitimate Palestinian entity that would rule over Gaza. So that is the premise there. And it's not distant from Northern Ireland. So basically, I recently saw a speech by Bertie Ahern, the Irish prime minister that presided over the decommissioning in Northern Ireland. And the speech is from January this year to a coalition called the Alliance for the Two-State Solution, Global Alliance for the Two-State Solution. And Bertie is saying explicitly, decommissioning meant that you would first have peace, then you would get rid of the weapons. That disarmament is not the prerequisite to peace, it's rather the outcome of it. And he says, if we insisted on it the other way around, we would have never had peace in Northern Ireland. There would be still war, there would be still civil war between the IRA and the Ulsters until today. And Bertie is saying that between the Good Friday Agreement and the actual disarmament, there was about 10 years to 11 years of weapons being put out of use, out of sight, out of display, locked up in depots. In that case, the weapons functioned as an insurance card, a card of leverage for the IRA, for the Ulsters, that if the peace agreement is violated, you can take them out again. So that created the trust that the agreement would be fulfilled. The IRA, I think around 2001, declared that they would suspend the decommissioning process because Britain was not acting in good faith and did not pull its troops out of Northern Ireland and did not fulfill a couple of criteria in the Good Friday Agreement. And then Britain had to abide by it. So the weapons functioned as the guarantee that the agreement would be seen all the way through. Hamas today is in the exact same position. They've offered total decommissioning, a strict policy of no use, no display, that whatever authority is going to be in Gaza would be authorized to detain, arrest, lock up, shoot to kill anyone that would show a weapon publicly or engage in basically any armed activities when there is a ceasefire that is respected by both sides. And Hamas was saying that we can do this, lock all the weapons up in depots for the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and then what? You need an agreement to end the Palestinian question, to end Israel's apartheid. And once that agreement is in place, you can take all those weapons and drown them down the ocean. That is the proposal there. It happens to be the proposal that was endorsed by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, and Ireland. I was just in Ireland a couple of days ago and met with people at the foreign ministry that told me that the United Kingdom even established a team that would look into the mechanics, the basically nitty-gritty details of how this kind of decommissioning would play out in reality. Then you had Netanyahu and Mladenov flipping it the other way around. Now they came up with what is called disarmament. Disarmament means surrender everything you have. You have absolutely no leverage whatsoever. And trust the genocidal powers that saw the annihilation of Gaza and carried it out with perfection, that they would be kind enough to you that after you give all of your weapons, you're going to get some kind of pie in the sky. That is the proposal on the table. And they know that it's deliberately unworkable. They played the same trick when Hamas won the elections in 2005 or 2006. You had back then what was called the Quartet Principles. Hamas needed to recognize Israel unilaterally, unrequitedly, renounce violence, dismantle its armed brigades, and honor the Oslo Accords that Israel violates every single day into virtual obsolescence. And back then, Jonathan Powell, the chief of staff of Tony Blair, admitted later on that those conditions were basically a scam. They were a stunt. They knew from the start, from the get-go, that it was a non-starter for any legitimate Palestinian government to accept. But they put it there in order to solicit a no for an answer that would then give them a free hand to dismantle, destroy, boycott, defund that government. And we see the same thing now.
Mohammed, you know, even when you talk about decommissioning, and this was clearly a useful mechanism in the context of Northern Ireland, but in the context of Northern Ireland, which is something that certainly people debate very passionately, there was a political process in which the political which took into account the political needs, demands, and rights of all of the parties participating in that process, and came up with a political mechanism for the resolution of the conflict, which provides for the possibility of a united Ireland, of ending British rule in Ireland, not immediately, but the right of the people to achieve that through a referendum is guaranteed, and people are talking about it. I just saw the other day a poll showing that a majority in Northern Ireland are now saying they would vote for a united Ireland. So that's a legitimate political outcome that is embodied in this process. And so in that context, decommissioning can be seen as a mechanism to get to a political outcome. In this context, even if you have the British, the Saudis, whoever else, the Irish, supporting decommissioning as a weapon, as a mechanism, as opposed to stripping the Palestinians of any weapons, as Israel and the United States and Mladenov want, they're still all on the same team, aren't they? Because they're still all saying it's Palestinian weapons that are the problem, not Zionism, not Israel's weapons of terror and massacres and genocide, not Israel's aggressive, violent, race-based colonization. They're still defining Palestinians as the problem and not Zionism and the aggression of Zionism, which they all back as the problem. So even those who are sort of more moderate are still on the wrong side. Is that a fair analysis? And do they understand that, or do they think they're the good guys?
With those governments in particular, you have Saudi, Egypt, Ireland. I'm not sure about the United Kingdom. I think the UK would be more than happy to see Palestinians completely gone, capitulating or just ceasing to exist. But with those three others, I know from behind the scenes that they've been invested in having a political dimension to decommissioning. And they've made it clear to the US that you cannot write off the Palestinian right to resist without offering them a political pathway. A political pathway is the more humble way of saying Israel is never going to accept a Palestinian state. So let's have a pretend process that might create some trust. Maybe one day you might change Israeli hearts and minds, and might get them to accept the two states through that kind of pathway. It's just basically pathways, the fancy way of saying another theatrical performance. But it's basically the most serious thing that we have on the table at the moment, vis-a-vis international community players. The difference between the Israel, US, Mladenov, and the decommissioning is basically the Mladenov proposal. It dismantles not just the weaponry of Hamas, which is not a lot at this stage. It dismantles the very concept of the Palestinian armed resistance or the right to resist in the first place in any shape or form, because both proposals that he handed to Hamas in Cairo and other Palestinian factions explicitly say that Israel would stay in over 20% of Gaza even after Hamas is fully dismantled and disarmed, and the last weapon, the last nail clipper, taser, pepper spray, baton, stick is taken out of Gaza, Israel would still remain in over 20% of Gaza until there is not even, quote, the prospect of the resurgence of a threat. What that means is basically you need to turn Palestinians into something that is way more meek and mild than basically like the most stereotype of the most meek and mild would be, let's say, the Swiss, although the Swiss are armed to the teeth. Canadians also armed to the teeth. It's basically like it doesn't exist. There's no nation on earth where you have a population that is so willingly defenseless and weaponless and entrusting their fate to the people that have been persecuting and genociding them for decades. But basically, that's the slight difference between the two is one of them needs a political process to add legitimacy to the decommissioning. So decommissioning here means freezing, no use, no display. The other one, it basically means surrender, capitulation. I agree that both of them are laying the blame squarely on Palestinian resistance rather than Israel's apartheid or Israel's genocide. Both of them engage in this kind of act. But this is precisely because the balance of powers, U.S. hegemony, the international system, all of it is rigged from the get-go, that the only way you can engage with it is basically trying to take something, give something. We're going to give the Israelis a little bit here in order to get something back. The problem is that those countries, those governments don't understand that Israel will never give anything in return. They will just keep moving the needle. So take, for example, the idea of reforming the Palestinian Authority. So the Palestinian Authority needs reform urgently. That is democratic renewal. That is transparency. That is anti-corruption. That is basic legitimate representation. That is embracing the Palestinian right to resist openly. The reforms that they mean is more capitulation to Israel. Erase anything about resistance from Palestinian textbooks. Turn Palestinian society into what is called cashless society with digital crypto wallets that are controlled by Israel in order for Israel to decide who gets food at the end of the day and who starves to death. There's this series of reforms. Oh, every single one of them is meant to turn the PA into a greater collaborator. Each country that has ever asked the Palestinian Authority to enact those reforms has told us behind the scenes that they know all of those reforms are bullshit, that none of it would convince the Israelis that the PA is, quote, a worthy partner. The PA, per the admission of the late Saeb Oreqat, has been murdering Palestinians to appease Israel, to build trust with Israel, to show worthiness of a state. And Israel keeps saying, no, you're unworthy, you need reform. But nonetheless, those countries are engaging in these theatrics of telling the PA, reform, and then you will get gain a foothold in Gaza. I think like part of it, it's because they are struck at a dead end with the U.S. refusing to budge. Part of it is, as we say, يَخْدُ تْرَمْبْ عَلَى أَدْعَالُ. And they think that if they play along with Trump's shenanigans, he might give them something in return. From my perspective, both are would prove to be completely delusional.
And Mohammed, what has been the response, if there has been any formal response so far by the Palestinian armed factions to these completely absurd colonial imperialist proposals? You know, the assumption that the Palestinian armed factions would just willingly surrender, and as you say, you know, trust this entity, this state that has been genociding and subjugating their people for so many decades. It seems like, you know, definitely a political dead end. But what does this mean? What has been the reaction so far by the factions?
Basically, Hamas, as well as the Palestinian Popular Front and the Democratic Front, so those are the liberal, secular, and communist Palestinian factions, as well as the Islamic Jihad and other political parties and armed factions in Gaza, all of them unanimously delivered the same answers to the mediators. Number one, get Israel to fulfill phase one of the deal before you talk to us about phase two. Basically, you had a test with phase one. Israel failed on every single metric in that test. They never fulfilled any of their obligations. Zero. None. And number two, they said, okay, you want to talk about weapons. We're happy to engage on this, but end the occupation and take all of our weapons with you home. That was the answer. We're willing to lay down our arms if the occupation is over. And there was the other answer. Okay, if you want to talk about weapons, we have, let's say, 60,000 Kalashnikovs in Gaza. Israel armed settlers to the extent of, I think, about 200,000 rifles, M16s and other automatic assault rifles in the West Bank within 12 months. That's in the West Bank, Israeli settlers alone. Nobody is bringing them up. There's no talk about decommissioning, disarmament there at all. So they tried to bring something in return to show the hypocrisy of this equation in the first place. They said also that decommissioning would require three things. Number one, a humanitarian track. Number two, a security track. And number three, a political track. Humanitarian track means you cannot ask a starving, shell-shocked, traumatized person living on the street in a tent surrounded by scorpions, mice, rats, and all kinds of diseases to lay down the very weapon that they believe is the only guarantee to either be able to strike back or to die honorably. You need to improve the humanitarian situation. That is the first prerequisite. Once you improve it to a level that Gaza is livable again, people would have the trust that, okay, we can put that weapon into hiding. We can put it in a warehouse. We can give it to an authority, a single authority, etc. And the security track, they said, okay, if Israel has, quote, security concerns, which is meaningless, Israel has, quote, security concerns, any serious Israeli analyst would on the record say that the chances of October 7th happening again are 0.000%. You have a nuclear armed state against an armed faction that is armed with Kalashnikovs. There is no comparison to begin with. Netanyahu himself said, I think about a couple of months ago in February, he said there is no weapons in Gaza to talk about in the first place. There is no artillery, there is no rockets, there is no ballistic missiles, there's only Kalashnikovs. And that's exactly what I want to take out. So basically, there is no comparison. But if you say, for the sake of argument, Israel has, quote, security concerns, Palestinians have security concerns as well, not just concerns, it's existential threats. So basically, you have the IDF still being inside Gaza. Israel is still occupying the entire territory. You have the armed proxy gangs that are populated in East Gaza, the area under Israel's control. You have the chances of Israel, after all of this is completed, even if you have a Palestinian state, you have peace, you have all of it, the chance of Israel just invading it and finishing off the Palestinian question would remain on the table. So what guarantees that this is not going to happen? What guarantees our basic survival? So that's the security track. You need to put any sort of defense mechanisms that ensure Israel would not get a free hand again. And the political track is the one that we discussed earlier. You cannot talk to us about disarmament before we talk about Palestinian statehood, because the weaponry is part of the Palestinian arm to resist under international law. The Palestinian right to resist is basically going to be there as long as the occupation is there. It's just as simple. That was the answer. The answer was slammed by Israel and Mladenov as, quote, maximalist, unreasonable, insane, lunatic, that Mladenov sent them a letter, a joint letter with a guy called Ari Lightstone. So that is the extremist American official that's in charge of implementing the Trump deal in Gaza. I've spoken to European officials that met him. I've asked what kind of person he is. They said, quote, he's more right-wing, more extreme than Netanyahu. And they said, quote, he hates Palestinians with passion. So that guy and Mladenov sent a joint letter to Hamas in return that was reported, I think, this morning in the Times of Israel, saying that if you don't accept the proposal as it is, Israel is absolved of all obligations under the Trump plan, period. So you're dealing with gangsters.
Yeah.
It reminds me, there is this, one of the Oslo Accords negotiators was a guy called Ron Pundek. And Pundek, he told Daniel Levy something like, it's insane how maximalist Israel is. Palestinians accepted 22% of their historic homeland. If we really mean peace, we would not sit and nitty-gritty negotiate this 1% here, this fraction there. We would tell them, okay, here's 23%, 24%. What is that 1% to us? And basically, lynching to the 22% is now seen as maximalist.
Well, that was always the case with Zionism. When you look at the big sweep of history, Zionists can't take yes for an answer because their goal is all the land with none of the people.
Yeah, and talk about maximalism. Yeah.
That hasn't changed, and we can see that in their approach to Gaza. An Israel that was interested in finding a way to live with the majority population, historic Palestine, which is the Palestinian people, would, from a self-interested Israeli perspective, want to improve the situation in Gaza, because Israel is creating the conditions. They may think that there can be no repeat of October 7th. Maybe there can't now, but there certainly will be in the future. There's no reason to believe that the resistance don't still have the capability to destroy Merkava tanks and Namer armored personnel carriers and so on. All that capacity still exists. But Israel, its goal appears to still be genocide. That's very clear. What's not so clear is why anyone would continue to go along with them, including someone like Mladenov, who certainly is smart enough to know better, even though he doesn't have the morals, it seems, to act on what he clearly knows. But I want to sort of, just in our remaining few minutes, Mohammed, broaden the discussion out to take a more regional perspective. Now, the demand that Hamas and the other resistance factions disarm unilaterally assumes that the United States and Israel still dominate the region to such an extent that they can just dictate terms and everyone else has to obey them. But the Israeli-American war of aggression against Iran exposed the real limits to that power and punctured the myth of total U.S.-Israeli supremacy. How does this wider regional shift affect Gaza? Does the fact that Iran has been able to stand up to the United States, to match its escalation and maintain escalation dominance, how does that weaken the pressure campaign around disarmament? Does it change the calculations of the Palestinian factions or the mediators? And does it create any opening for Palestinians that can be used to further resist this attempt to impose surrender by other means and to obtain from them what the so-called Israel Defense Force was unable to obtain on the battlefield?
Yep, absolutely. But before that, one point about Mladenov. Basically, when Mladenov left his post at the UN, there was an article celebrating him at the New York Times. The headline of the article was, quote, "He calmed Gaza. He calmed Gaza as a wild, barbaric monster." That was the headline. And I quarreled with the author of that article, and we had some sort of like argument back and forth about why did he use the terminology "calm Gaza." He got embarrassed to admit that basically it carried that connotation, that Gaza was this wild, untamed monster that Mladenov calmed. So that was his first achievement, pacification. The second one mentioned in the article is midwifery for the Abraham Accords, the very accords that were supposed to throw Palestinians under the bus, dismantle the Palestinian cause, and basically step on our graves. So that is his proudest achievements. As soon as he left his post, he became a visiting fellow at the AIPAC-backed Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This is a right-wing think tank in Washington that is one of the strongest pro-Israeli lobbies. So basically, it tells you everything about the guy, what to expect. In terms of the regional equation,
he was appointed by the UN previously. So does this give us an indication of the general quality of the UN officials who are supposed to be neutral and impartial, or is he a an outlying case?
Well, basically, with the UN, there is a lot of politics at hand. I met a few senior UN officials to ask about what goes behind the scenes. There is the annual list that the UN publishes of armies engaged in the systematic murder of children, abuse against children, and another list about systematic sexual violence in war and conflicts. Every year, Israel is rebuked systematically, repeatedly in those reports at length. The reports are written by experts, so they would document at length all the Israeli violations throughout the year. There is a list attached to that report, and the list is produced by the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. Every single year, he refused to add Israel there. So you would have the corpus, the body of the report, indicting Israel with crimes against humanity, and then Guterres chooses not to add Israel there. It's a political decision per excellence. I've asked people that know Guterres what kind of Secretary General he is, and they said he would never shut up about this being overly apologetic to Israelis constantly. Whenever he would meet any Israeli officials, he would immediately bring up that when he was prime minister in Portugal, to atone for his sins, his first act was to go and visit a synagogue and cry there and apologize and show compassion and basically repentance for the Inquisition. To my understanding, he never displayed the same kind of humanity at any mosque in Portugal, although Muslims were the overwhelming majority of people that were purged in Spain and Portugal in those Inquisitions. So basically, if you contrast it to even Ban Ki-moon, so Ban Ki-moon was a horrible Secretary General. In Gaza in 2014, we memorized any statement that he would ever release before he released it. It would always say, "I express concern, 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 concern," nothing more. That was a repeated phrase. But one time, the guys from AIPAC, ADL and others, so basically the Israel lobby in Washington, went and met with Ban Ki-moon during the 2014 assault on Gaza. And they sort of bombarded him with complaints. They were saying, you need to be more less biased against Israel. You need to do more for the Israelis. Israel's right to self-defense. And then he exploded at them in a very sort of English South Korean accent and said, "Your army, your prime minister, they're doing war crimes. They're going too far. They're destroying entire neighborhoods." And then they told him, they pulled the anti-Semitism card. They said, "Netanyahu is not our prime minister. We are Jews. We're not Israelis." And then he told them a simple mic drop moment. He said, "Well, one time President Donald Reagan went and met with the president of Pakistan. And in their meeting, the president of Pakistan kept saying, 'India is doing this, India is doing that.' And Reagan said at the press conference, 'I would like to thank the president of India.' And he was corrected, 'That's the president of Pakistan.' To which Reagan responded, 'Then why on earth couldn't he shut up about India?'" And he said, "I direct the same question to you." So even Ban Ki-moon had a little bit of spine behind closed doors. With Guterres, it didn't seem to be the case. It was the enormous pressure from civil servants, career diplomats at the UN, that kept escalating from the base top to the top that created eventually the pressure on him to issue those mild speeches every once in a while. And he was very traumatized. That's what the officials around him told me. He was very traumatized, shell-shocked by Israel's reaction. He thought that he cultivated a very strong friendship. He did not expect to be called an anti-Semite immediately. There's other UN officials. I think Sigrid Kaag was appointed as a special envoy for Gaza by Guterres. And my understanding is that her main mission back then was the issue of disarmament, the issue of security par excellence. So there is a lot of politics that go there. With the other question about regional dynamics, what you have there is, with the whole war on Iran, Israel, after 2.5 years of relentless, unprecedented warfare and genocide, failed to disarm and dismantle a very, very, very tiny armed group compared to the Iranians. So basically, the Israelis, as one official, Arab official put it, the Israeli approach is to hit your head against the wall. If it doesn't collapse, hit harder. It would collapse next time. So basically, they tried it now with Iran. It didn't work either. The main danger of Iran to Israel and to some regional powers is not just the issue of how this conflict is going to end. Is Iran going to open the Strait of Hormuz, not the nuclear weapons, etc.? It's a more ideological threat on Israel. Iran, the whole escalation there showed that if you stand your ground, if you hit back, you strike back, you maintain steadfastness, you will get your way, no matter how overwhelming power is displayed and used against you. And that lesson was immediately caught by people in Gaza, armed factions in specific. It made them even more uncompromising on accepting the Mladenov proposal by saying that the lesson there is very clear. You can maintain your steadfastness, you can strike back, and you can get your way. Once the balance of power is shifting here and there, etc., there is the other fear. So basically, with this whole genocide in Gaza, one of the main goals of it, and one of the main goals why it got support, again, from some regional powers, from some regional regimes, is to turn Gaza into a cautionary tale for the Arab public, to tell them, if you raise your head, if you rebel, if you demand democracy, if you demand rule of law, if you demand anything, you're going to turn into Gaza. Gaza was supposed to be the ultimate scarecrow, so it failed there. It's the same in Iran. They're very afraid that if Iran gets its way, it would prove the exact opposite lesson. That basically, there is a reason why there is this, right now in the Arab street, there is this overwhelming support to the Iranian side against the U.S. and Israel. There's, of course, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. There's the other one, basically the underdog dynamic. And there's the one of sticking it up to the very rulers, the very autocratic regimes that are suppressing us in the name of keeping us safe and happy and quiet and whatever.
Well, ultimately, people understand that this is an anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggle. And Israel and the U.S. and their vassals are on the side of the empire, and Iran and its allies are against the empire. And people can spin that any way they want to, but that's the reality. That's my opinion. I don't make anyone else associate with it. But I think the so-called Arab Street understands that. That's why they don't buy into all of the stories about how Iran is really their enemy and not Israel, even though there is Arab and regional media pushing that line, and some governments, of course. A final question, unless Nora may have something too, but just from me, Mohammed, is this so-called ceasefire is going on 7 months. The situation in Gaza is dire, as we just heard from Nora in her news report, and as we hear every week, and as we read from the reporting that comes out of Gaza, there was a so-called ceasefire in Lebanon from November of 2024 until November 2024 until March the 1st this year, in which Israel continued to kill and bomb and destroy in Lebanon, and the so-called political process failed to stop Israel. The so-called guarantors or mediators of that ceasefire put no pressure on Israel to withdraw from Lebanon or stop its attacks. And eventually, the resistance in Lebanon made the calculation, in the context of the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran, the resistance in Lebanon made the calculation that it is better for us to fight and to liberate our land ourselves than to continue with a one-sided ceasefire in which Israel continues to kill us. Do you think a similar moment could arrive in Gaza, where the Israeli tanks, the Israeli bulldozers that are inside Gaza, carrying out the demolitions of buildings that are still standing, might once again be targeted by the resistance?
So basically, Palestinian factions in Gaza are always looking out for other examples and learning. They're very adaptable. Palestinian armed factions are not driven solely by ideology. They're more experimental. They look for the context, the time, what works, what doesn't work, etc. And they've seen three lessons in the last few years. Number one is the one with the Taliban, that basically Biden, Trump eventually bowed down, pulled out of Afghanistan, and the Taliban got to rule over. Number two is the example of Syria, that you had Ahmad al-Sharaa trying to find some political accommodation with the U.S., with the West, etc., which only turned out to be a humiliation for him. Israel still occupies an area that is, I think, about three or four times the size of Gaza inside Syria. They're still invading, bombing, raiding, militarily attacking Syria constantly. And there is an endless list of demands that is made on the Sharia government. There was the success with removing the sanctions, diplomatic breakthrough, a Sharia being welcomed to London, to Germany, Berlin, etc., other European capitals. So it had this sort of cost-benefit analysis. Is it worth it? Is it not? And there is now the third model of the Iranians slash Hezbollah, where you had basically an army or an entity that was capable of striking back the U.S. and Israel and forcing its demands on the table and then getting the Americans to sit on that table and try to negotiate something out. In those three examples, in Gaza, there is the two schools of thought. There is a group saying, well, if we try to do anything right now, this is exactly what Israel wants in order to finish the job. They will use it as an excuse. As you saw in the case of Lebanon, Israel violated the ceasefire thousands of times. They killed hundreds of people since it was signed in 2024. I read a tally that put, I think, the number around 1,000 people that were killed, maimed, etc., or more. But as soon as Hezbollah fired a single rocket, you immediately got the European Union, as well as the international community, condemning Hezbollah for collapsing the ceasefire deal. There was no mention of the Israeli attacks on the day before, or basically the hundreds of days that preceded. So the story always begins as soon as Palestinians or Hezbollah or Lebanese factions fire. So there is the concern about that. Netanyahu in recent months has been pitching Trump the idea that allowing him to finish Gaza off, to finish the job there, would secure Trump, quote, a Nobel Peace Prize. Literally, he's telling Trump this would secure peace for prosperity in the Middle East. It would get the Saudi Arabians to normalize with us. It would solve the Palestinian question permanently. You would get your Nobel Peace Prize. So there is the fear that if we try to strike back, Israel would use it. It would be the ultimate gift to them. On the other hand, there is the belief that is growing and increasing by the minute, as put by Gideon Levy all the way in 2018, that when Palestinians don't fire, nobody listens. They disappear. I've heard as much from European officials. There's other Israeli officials that admitted it on the record that said Palestinians, as soon as they stop firing, nobody wants to talk about them. It's off everybody's mind, off everybody's agenda. I've been talking to people at different European foreign ministries, France, Germany, Sweden, Ireland, Norway, and every single one of them has been telling me that it became an insane struggle. As soon as the Trump ceasefire plan was signed, it became an insane struggle to bring Gaza up to their superiors. Nobody wants to talk about it anymore. It's completely gone. So there is now the belief that is being cultivated by that neglect of Gaza that the only way to put it back on the agenda is some sort of an escalation. The only way to reset the clock, start talks all over, get people running to Gaza. Even before all of this, even before October 7th, people in Gaza understood, okay, the only way you would get Mladenov running to Gaza, as well as all of those negotiators, is as soon as the first rocket is fired there. That became the lesson. People in Gaza even gave it a name. They called it anesthetics, Iberbenj, basically drugs, that whenever an escalation erupts, Mladenov and others would come in, they would promise a few pacifying painkillers, leave, and that's it. So they understand that equation as well. So there is the risk there that even if you escalate, you put Gaza on the agenda again, it would end up with anesthetics. It's really hard to tell what would be the way out in both of these equations, whether to stick to the talks that you know are dishonest, aren't going nowhere, they will keep running in circles, or escalate and get the blame for it. It's a very tough situation to be in.
Yeah. It certainly is. And I'm personally more and more of the view that the liberation of Palestine is tied to the liberation of the region. And the liberation of the region means the liberation of the region from U.S. imperialism and Zionism. And wherever people are fighting for the liberation of the region, they're also fighting for the liberation of Palestine and vice versa. You know, that is a legitimate struggle. people in the United States have the right to live in a free democratic country. They don't have the right to rule over the rest of the world as imperial masters. That is the struggle that people are waging in the region according to their rights. I have to be very careful how I say things on YouTube. But that's basically my viewpoint, my personal view, not the view of anyone else. I'm always careful to say that. And Muhammad, you have so much information and so much insight, and we're so grateful to you for sharing it with us. And just to remind people that you are a writer and analyst from Gaza, although you're not in Gaza right now. You are also a visiting fellow at the European Center for Foreign Relations. And I would say you do the best work there. I'm not a big fan of all these think tanks, but you make that... you're the only person I would ever read at a think tank like that. No insult to them, but that's just credit where it's due. And you are very active on Twitter X, and you write frequently, and you give interviews like this, which are just so rich and full of insight and knowledge. So thank you so much, Muhammad. We love to have you at the Electronic Intifada, so we will hope to have you again soon.
Absolutely.
Muhammad.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic interview. Just
really so thorough. Better the second time, because of course we were talking to him yesterday, and now listening to it again, I get so much more out of it.
Yeah.
So he's really brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. Just unbearable. These colonialist terms that the U.S. and the so-called and Trump's Board of Peace and Israel, of course, is trying to force on the people in Gaza. And of course, you know, as Muhammad said, this would be a blueprint for other people in the region. You know, I mean, this is, it's unbearable. So,
yeah. And, you know, all the sort of rich detail, I mean, we know the basic colonial structure here, but Muhammad fills in so much detail. And I think one thing that I reflect on listening to that is that the colonialists, the imperialists, always underestimate their victims.
Yeah.
And I think they are underestimating, just as they underestimated the Lebanese resistance, they're also underestimating the Palestinian resistance.
That's right.
And as they underestimated Iran and Yemen and anyone who stands up to them.
Yeah. Yes. Well, wonderful. And I encourage everyone to go back and watch that again. You know, we're going to have that as a separate segment on our YouTube channel. So if you, you know, just it's always good to keep filling up your reserves with really incredible analysis and deep looks at some of the machinations of what these imperial forces are trying to force on people. So thank you for that. Let's bring John on. I'm talking about the resistance and the underestimating of what's happening in Lebanon. Hi, John.
Hello. That was a good interview.
Yeah. Hi, John. Thanks.
They have lots of weapons that can kill five soldiers.
And they're not giving them up.
Yeah. It's not just the rockets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
As our loyal watchers know.
Yeah. well, give us a little preview of what you're going to be talking about today in terms of Lebanon.
Drones.
Lots of drones.
Hezbollah has reshaped the battlefield in Lebanon using them. And they're just a remarkable tool because they bring, you know, in the same way the GoPro cameras did in Gaza, these drones just take you right into the middle of the battlefield. And the way that you can watch the targeting develop just in these 6 or 8 weeks, I guess 8 weeks. This is week eight, I think. Yeah. Is it week eight? I forget what I put in my intro. I've lost track of time.
Yeah.
I think it's week eight I'm covering.
Okay.
But yeah, you can see the development in just that short amount of time. So the weeks and months ahead portend a serious struggle for Israel in its attempt to hold territory in Lebanon. So,
and you're also going to give as much of an update as you can on what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz and the U.S.'s attempt to blockade the blockade. And
we're trying not to chase Trump's idiocy around in circles. So we'll do our best to value out of that.
All right. Well, Ali, do you want to do the honors?
Yeah. Why don't you? I'm trying to think of a good drone related pun. Why don't you take off, John?
Take off.
All right. You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report on day 944 of Israel's genocide in Gaza, day 69 of Israel and the U.S.'s war on Iran, and day 66 of Hezbollah's defense of South Lebanon. I'll be covering Lebanon today, but first, a word on the Iran war and the Strait of Hormuz. Let's take a look at this first map. The IRGC Navy put out a map this week that showed an expanding blockade. We're looking at a map here of the Strait of Hormuz zoomed in, and the blockade has extended just right up to the UAE's number one export port, oil exporting port, and on the other side, the entrance to the Strait of Hormuz. So that's become now a closed military zone, everything that's in between those red lines. And of course, the U.S. has added their blockade on top of that. Tehran is still running their traffic separation scheme that runs in the red that you could see up towards the north along the Iranian, closer to the Iranian coast. And the U.S. this week on Sunday, Trump in his market manipulation, weekly market manipulation, launched what he said was called Project Freedom. And he suggested in his message that the U.S. would be escorting ships. There's more than 1,000 ships caught in the Persian Gulf and aren't able to leave. And the idea was floated that they would be escorted. That didn't happen. It happened to two ships, apparently two American ships, American flag ships, sailed out of the Strait of Hormuz. Everything that is related to the American blockade is, it presumes that no one's sailing back in to the Gulf. So these are long-term global economy destroying blockades that the Americans seem to not understand the consequences of on global markets. And all of these plans just stretch this this period of uncertainty out. And I'll remind you what I said on the first shows about this war. Every day that the Strait is closed, it takes at least a week to fix that day. And it gets worse the longer it goes. So we're now 69 days. So we're talking like we're starting to push into 3 months to correct the mistakes, a year and a quarter to fix the mistakes. And so this is a long-term problem that is not going to be fixed by U.S. escorts. So if we look at the next map, escorts, not even what the Americans have in mind. The term is convoy in naval affairs, that they would convoy ships in and out of the Strait. The Project Freedom lasted for 36 hours and Trump canceled it. But the logistics, I've talked about this a couple of times on this show, the logistics of escorting ships through the Strait, that in itself, were it to even be possible, if Iran were to say we're not even going to fire on those escorts, which they did fire on the first one that happened, the escort would take, to get 1,000 ships out of the Gulf would take months. And the global economy is on a clock. And the Americans believe that Iran is on a clock. And I think that we can look and see that the resilience of Iran is going to outpace that of the global economy, and particularly the Gulf states economy, which you can see on this map here from the New York Times, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, major oil terminals in Saudi as well, major oil terminals all through the Persian Gulf are effectively shut down. This was the first month that Kuwait didn't export one barrel of oil for the first time in 30 years. And a lot of the oil installations themselves have to be shut down. They have to be refired up to get back up to pace. So we're looking at a multi-year tail on this story of the Strait of Hormuz. In any case, Trump's escorts were not escorts. He was setting up a hotline, a coordination cell where commercial shippers could radio to the U.S. to ask what the best route was to get out. And the American regime painted it as a red, white, and blue dome. So it wasn't a ship escort. It's not a guided missile destroyer escort. And if you look at the coastline of this map here, you can see why if Iran chose to attack those ships, and the reason why there hasn't been U.S. warships transiting the strait over the past 70 days, they have all of the advantages, the geographic advantages, high terrain, missiles embedded all along the coast. The entire Persian Gulf's northern shore is Iran. And so they really do have every benefit, and the Americans have none. It did nothing to calm shippers who are and mariners. There's some 20,000 mariners who are stuck in the Persian Gulf. This hotline that Trump set up that died 36 hours later wasn't going to do it. But the American regime did say that the Operation Epic Fury is over. We're not sure if all aspects of the regime are talking off the same page. That was Marco Rubio yesterday, and he was, or on Tuesday. And yeah, it's not clear how much connection he has, but he said the war is over. He said this part of the war is over. This blockade is a new project. And then that new project lasted 36 hours. So let's look at the next map and just remind people what the geography looks like. This is what Iran looks like for ships going through the Strait of Hormuz. We're looking at a map that shows the geophysical, the physical geography of Iran, which just has overwatch over the entire Persian Gulf. It has that rocky shoreline where they can dispense ships, small fast boats from, like Boston Whaler type boats that have that are armed, that can swarm ships. They can fire anti-ship cruise missiles from those shorelines. They can fire anti-ship ballistic missiles, and they fire them so close to the ships that the ability of those ships to defend themselves are they're thin. And that is the reason why we haven't seen. If Trump wanted to declare victory, he would have steamed his ships through the strait and shown that the strait was open, and then said the war was over and we won. But there's no way that he can say we won in this current situation. So it's just a stalemate. It's an unsustainable stalemate. The blockade's porous. Iran is getting ships out. The Americans are not, and the Gulf states by and large are not. So it's a stalemate, but it strongly favors Iran in this situation. And we'll see how long this lasts in this part of the war. But let's take a look at Lebanon now. We'll focus today on Lebanon. I'm going to focus on three key areas just north of Nakoura on the coast there that you see in the bottom left of the map. Ras al Bayada is the area that the Israelis have set up a forward base north of Nakoura, south of Sur or Tyre there on the western coast. The Latani River is, of course, where Israel said that they were going to conquer all the territory below it, but they're not even close. They're only within a few kilometers of the border. Bint Jebel there in the central area, that is where there's been a lot of fighting, and we're going to watch a lot of video from there because there's a lot of American Israeli troops there. Still six divisions deployed here in the battle in Lebanon. No ceasefire. Both sides are saying there's no ceasefire right now. So Bint Jebel, we'll see a lot of operations there. And then if you follow up the Galilee Panhandle, as it's called, up to the northern tip of Israel, and the fighting is in to the west of that through the valleys and mountains to the west of the Galilee Panhandle and the famous valleys from the 2006 war, Wadi Saluki, that was where the Merkava the graveyard of the Merkava was when they attempted to invade through that path. That's where the fighting is happening there. So those three places we'll keep an eye on this show. There was more than 150 civilians killed this week, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Health. And we've been watching that, of course, consistently. Israel's war is on civilians. Their goal is not to fight Hezbollah. Their goal is to destroy civilian homes in South Lebanon to make there be nowhere to return to. This is the Beit Hanun and Rafah model from Gaza, which was previously borrowed from the Dahiya doctrine from Lebanon, but escalated dramatically in Gaza. So on this first video that we're going to see, just keep your eye peeled. You're going to watch a drone come from the right side of the screen to the left side as it hits a tank, number three here. And this was the first operation. There you see it strike the tank. This was the first operation where we've seen two cameras. So we have a drone assessing battle damage assessments, and you can see there the Merkava tank got hit in the turret. We'll see the drone here. This is moments earlier, and now we're on board with the drone, and you can see the tank is 12 o'clock, and the drone with the PG-7VL warhead comes in, and you can see here both hatches are open, the loader's hatch and the commander's hatch. Are both open. So this RPG round goes directly into the hatch and carry, and that's where you see, now we're seeing the above shot. That's what creates the cook-off. It lights up the ammo that's in the loader's bay and in the turret and in the storage areas beside it. So this is a pretty significant visual, but it's only, we're only seeing this because of the second camera. We don't see these burn offs. To say it's not accurate to say this is the first tank we've seen burning. I've shown you multiple burning tanks before on the show, from thermal cameras, from anti-tank guided missile strikes, but we don't have the second camera on these, and I wouldn't advise having multiple cameras on these operations overall, because they're more useful as attack than to show military media. But a significant operation here, that cook-off obviously caught the Israelis' attention, and the Hezbollah fighters obviously knew that that position was weakened, and that's why they put the second camera up so we could have a battle damage assessment, and we certainly got that from that video. Let's take a look at number four, because we've seen the real development day by day. We see the advance of the piloting of these, of the targeting of these. Here we're flying over Kantara. This is in up in towards the north of the Galilee panhandle, to the west of it. You're seeing multiple targets seen on this flight. So you see a couple of tanks here directly going down onto the tank, and you're going to see the gap between the turret and the hull of the tank. That looks to be where this RPG round is being aimed, and as we know from Gaza, that is one of the places that you definitely want, the fighters definitely want to be aiming for, and that appears to be a direct hit on that. Army radio this week had another panicked report about operators realizing that Hezbollah drones were being deployed from more than 20 kilometers deep. So even the fiber optic drones being deployed from more than 20 kilometers from the border, and Israel is attempting to set up a security zone that is a few kilometers. In some areas, it's 5 kilometers. In some areas, it's only hundreds of meters. But they said this week that on Army radio that the defense is bound to be breached and responses to drones is currently lagging, a senior IDF official told Army radio. So they are still have no solution for these, as you see the direct hit here on the turret gap of this Merkava tank. Let's take a look at the next one. These are two shots of artillery a position that was hit. That is an artillery bus, essentially a humper of artillery rounds and and it was hit. And around it, there was a number of vehicles that were hit as well that burned up in this trike. This is in Shamara. This is just across the border from Bit Djbel. More than at least 12 soldiers were wounded. An army radio said that several other soldiers suffered from anxiety from this attack. They're pretty scared, and they needed to have treatment from this attack. Again, this is an intelligence-driven attack on an artillery position that is firing into South Lebanon, and the reason why people are dying at the rate they are in Lebanon. So to pick this target just shows, again, one of the assets of these drones is that you're getting constant aerial surveillance, which Hezbollah already had excellent intelligence that we know. But these two shots show you the precise intelligence, because that's put out this artillery unit, this artillery position put out of service for some time. Let's take a look at number seven, because they're going after an artillery position here too. Now we're moving over to the western coast. This is Ras El Bayada, the Bayada headland here. We've seen this shot many times because this Israeli forward base has been targeted literally every single day in this last period. And you're going to see this, we're watching the flight here, and look down now, you'll see that's the Israeli military base. You can see the tarp, the canvas roof over their tents there. You can see the excavators that built the anti-tank berms that are around there. And now you see it's locking in on its target. It passed on all of those different targets and is heading in here to an artillery position that you're going to watch be struck directly. And that's an M113. We saw these used as truck bombs in Gaza. These are old, out-of-stock armored personnel carriers. You can see it in the next slide, the still the way that the artillery position is set up. So this is the command position for the artillery battery, and Hezbollah hits it. So smart target choosing, if that's the right word. For the Israelis, they call when over the radio, we saw journalists were in Bayada on the day of this, and the journos heard on the radio air hammer, which is what the IDF alert for incoming drones are, and they rushed the Israeli journalists out of there quickly. But they're obviously setting up a major position here. But the position, the part of the position that's doing harm in Lebanon is this artillery command and control post, and it's been wiped out. So Hezbollah targeting those that are killing people in Lebanon out of the many targets they have on these bases. Let's look at the next one, because we're still in Bayada here. Again, daily, sometimes multiple times a day, targeting this same base in the western sector. And Israel doesn't seem to have much defense for these. Hezbollah is learning which targets to hit here. So they're going to be hitting a group of Humvees here, which is, you know, in the lexicon of Gaza, this is an appropriate weapon for a Humvee. You can certainly disable tanks. We watched it just happen a few moments ago. But the single round RPG, a single charge RPG round is really best designed for these Humvees, for the M113s, for that artillery position. Those are smart targets. Let's look at the next one, because it's the same. We've got three in a row here. They've here we see them building them. This was also the part of the genius that all the fighters can assemble these drones, and we're watching them assemble. There's the fiber optic spool that's going to run a fiber optic cable behind it, allowing for low latency, no jamming, just strong response between the controller, the pilot, and the drone itself. And again, we're in the exact same spot. So this is drone after drone targeting these same spots. We're coming back to these Humvees. And over the course of just this last week, all these operations are just in the last week since you last saw me. But they're wiping out these Humvees. A single RPG round on that Humvee will blow that Humvee to pieces and presumably burn the ones beside it. So we're seeing single hits here, but surely multiple destroyed Humvees in this strike. There's one more to number 11 over the same area, again, same base. And one of the things to note is that we haven't seen soldiers in all of these videos. The Israelis are hiding. There's been a few psyops that the Hezbollah media arm has put out saying, like, where are you guys? Because we haven't seen any soldiers on these bases. But while targeting these Humvees and tanks, the Israeli soldiers are somewhere within a very, very short walking distance of these armored vehicles. So it's, I don't want to make predictions, but I think we're going to see an increase in attacks on Israeli soldiers as this goes on in South Lebanon. So there's another Humvee completely destroyed. Let's look at the next one, 11B here. This is from yesterday. And amid all of the discussions in Israel about what we can do, what Israel can do, you know, I say we like them. They're talking about what are we going to do about these drones? Do we make big nets? Here they have a counter UAV system, and Hezbollah's just flying their drone directly into Israel's counter FPV drone system. So this system is set up to essentially be perimeter security for incoming FPV drones, and Israel sets it up and Hezbollah destroys it with an FPV drone. So this is designed to stop FPV drones, and Hezbollah picks it out of a window like the old soldiers in a window day. They have their drone protection system in a window. So this is an anti-FPV drone system that's about to knock out be knocked out by an FPV drone. So one step forward, two steps back for the Israelis. We can go to the next one because there was soldiers here. And when we see the soldiers here, the fact that there is such intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance all over these positions, Hezbollah noticed three jeeps arrive with a combat intelligence battalion that they identified here. And we're going to watch the soldiers get out of their jeep, and within, you know, it looks like a few dozen feet of the jeep, they're immediately targeted by this incoming explosive-laden FPV drone. So there you see their jeeps, and you can look at them. They're spitting distance from getting out of their jeeps, and they're immediately targeted. Here, there's the three of them on the ground. The Israelis said two were wounded here, but you can watch the video, and we're not so sure about those. We've never been sure about Israel's casualty reports. We remain skeptical of them. Let's take a look at 13, or we can look at this one more. Yeah, it's okay. Look at 13 here. Again, we're seeing, this is something we saw later in the week, this crisp digital video feed. So we may be seeing a lot crisper attacks on Israelis. This is an attack. We're moving now to Bint Ishbel, and you can see there's a tank upcoming there on the road. Now it's getting the Hezbollah circle, triangle in Gaza, circle in Lebanon. It gets the red circle and a direct hit on it looks like this is a hit on the commander's hatch, which we've seen them picking on a number of times. We saw a video yesterday that didn't make it in, that missed our deadline, but we'll show you next week where they're aiming at the commander's hatch as well. So they're clearly advancing their targets, and that's, I think, appropriate with the RPG round that they are using. Let's look at number 14. This is versus three tanks. I stitched these together just so we didn't spend the whole show watching the flights over South Lebanon, although it's beautiful to watch the flights because it's a beautiful area. And, you know, the reason why people are fighting so hard for this area is shown in these videos. The destruction by Israel, the genocidal ethnic cleansing is seen in every picture. Here you see a hit on the reverse on the back end. Again, that is also right by the loader's hatch in that. So we could be seeing that consistently. And then we have a couple of Namur troop carriers down here that are going to be targeted. And again, in each of those buildings, what we saw in Gaza was that Israel would destroy all of the buildings and then just leave one building that they were they had their troops in. We can see what they're doing here in Lebanon is they're spreading out their people. So there are soldiers in that building that are behind those tanks, because those tanks, they're not getting out of the troop carrier and walking through the village. So they're right there in those buildings. And I think we'll probably see in coming weeks them targeted. On that day of those operations, these were on the 30th of April, Israel admitted that two soldiers were wounded inside tanks. So again, we don't get battle damage assessments, but we can sometimes read between the lines on the Israeli casualty reports and see that two were wounded inside tanks. So these clearly work. They might not be the most appropriate weapon for the thickness of the armor on the Merkava. And that's what we saw in Gaza. And that's why the tandem warhead in Gaza was such a game changer. Let's take a look at number 15 now. Again, spring in South Lebanon. And then very quickly, you see total destruction in Bintish Baal. It looks as though the Israelis are attempting to erase Bintish Baal, which we can clearly see from this footage and lots of other footage as well. Here's going to pick up multiple targets again. And that's one of the reasons that these drones are so useful, is that they can loiter over the site. They reach the site and then they can fly around, and here they see a Namer with its rear door open. And that certainly... you put an 93 millimeter PG-7VL RPG warhead into the inside of that Namer, and it's going to destroy it. In another report, this is not related to this video, so there's a second report from Wednesday that a Namer was hit, and according to the Hezbollah field report, it was seen burning, and then soldiers were seen evacuating. And then Hezbollah says the fighters targeted the evacuation force with artillery shells, and enemy soldiers were seen fleeing from the area. So there's destruction happening to these vehicles. There's no question about it. But there is large parts of the Merkava and the Namer. And the Namer is a Merkava just without a turret. So here we go, right through the back door. Okay, we go to the next one now, because we can see it with a closed door on this next one. Again, that right there is where soldiers are. And watch this drone pilot get some reconnaissance in before he carries out his attack. He's looking under that. You can see there's a vehicle, the tarp, that's to protect the soldiers that are clearly inside that building. So full recon of the site. And now the fighters that are back with the controller, although this can happen with just one person, that's the video pilot. That's the advantage of the video piloting. It can be a single person. You don't need anything to launch these drones. We've seen them launch them off of cinder blocks. You can launch them off your hand. But back at where they are launching from, you have intelligence units that are watching each of these positions. They know each of the positions, where they change day in and day out. And so here they see a Namer. They pass on hitting the front of those Namers that are facing it, which wouldn't do any damage. But this here, to hit the back door directly on the latch, we know that from Gaza will blow out that back door. Qassam did that in Gaza a number of times. So these are destroying Israeli armor. And we've seen that through this whole week. This Namer is probably destroyed. The previous Namer is for sure destroyed. You put an RPG round into the cabin of it, and it's going to burn. Let's take a look at the next one. This is a D9 armored bulldozer, also in Bintish Baal. So we've seen multiple Namers. We just saw, but somewhere between 3 and 6 at least Humvees destroyed. We saw the cook-off of the Merkava in the first video. This is one of two D9s on this show that we're watching being destroyed. And again, this RPG round that the FPV quadcopter is carrying will destroy a D9 armored bulldozer. And that's why in Gaza, you can see it there, they identify tanks. But they're going to pass on those tanks and hit a more appropriate target, which is the bulldozer that is actively demolishing Bintij Bail on the one hand, but also does not have defenses for a single round RPG. And that's why in Gaza, we never saw Yassin 105s fired at bulldozers, because it's unnecessary. An appropriate weapon is a single round RPG, and he's going to put this right through the base of that D9 in Bintij Bail. Let's take a look at 18, because while there's a lot of focus on FPV drones, we'll watch it one more time. Okay, go. All right, here we go. So here is a PSYOP that Hezbollah put out this week, manufacturing the other kinds of drones that they fire in the first period before this so-called ceasefire that doesn't exist. You know, there's more than 400 drone operations that were not strictly all FPV drones. We know about these other drones, the Syed 107s, Shahed 101s, and here they're making an Ababil, which looks like an Ababil 2T version that they're putting together. So there are two types of drones being made here. And they're going to tell you that it's the pride of Lebanese industry. Again, we saw a bunch of these videos from Gaza about manufacturing their own weaponry. But those drones, they build their own larger fixed wing drones. They also put together their FPV drones from component parts. And that's the wisdom of both aspects of this, that you can manufacture this locally. And Hezbollah has been doing it there. You see the pride of Lebanese industry. There's been a number of these PSYOPs this week. And then this is those drones being launched, the same drones that you just saw being built. Here they are being launched. This first one is the Syed 107. And this is versus, and you can see there, that's, again, pressure, air pressure launched, so they don't leave a large heat signature, fiberglass, frame, low signature, and Israel has a lot of trouble with these as well. And Hezbollah can fire them from safe positions. And there's the Ababil that we watched be built. This carries a heavier warhead launched against Israeli troops, and dozens of injuries to troops from these drone strikes. There was just 10 more said were wounded today. There's a good shot of the Ababil with the forward wings on the nose cone. That's how you tell the difference between those ones. Here it is launched again. It's launched again. Okay, let's take a look at number 19. There's some anti-aircraft operations. This is a 358 missile. We're going to actually watch it get launched. We don't usually get to see that, so that's a bit of a treat for people who have been watching this 358 missile down MQ-9 Reaper drones. This is a Hermes 450. We've watched the Hermes 900 Elbit drones just get blown to pieces like we're watching here on screen. And we're watching it through the, through the missile's sights there. So that's the missile that has taken down dozens of MQ-9 Reaper drones, the biggest US or the most commonly used large US drone. The Yemenis down two dozen of them. In Iran, there's been dozens of them as well. And Hezbollah has used these in South Lebanon as well. And so of all these destroyed vehicles, we saw the Namur, we saw the half a dozen Humvees, we saw the Merkava, we saw two D9s. There was an excavator crew that were killed that are contract workers that are paid to by the number of houses they destroy. We saw that excavator be destroyed. We saw that artillery bus be destroyed, an M113 destroyed, a counter unmanned aerial system destroyed. So a lot of physical equipment losses. And if we look to the next, if we looked here, this Israel bragged about this week, that since the launch of what they call Operation Roaring Lion, so the Iran war and Lebanon war, Israel has received more than 115,000 600 tons of military equipment from the U.S. in 403 airlifts and 10 sea lifts. So we can see these next couple of pictures. These are the unloading of vehicles that we just watched be destroyed in Lebanon. And this is the only way that Israel is able to fight. I've been saying this since early Gaza. There's the Hemet. We watched those get destroyed last week on the show, being resupplied for free from the Americans, $25 billion in this resupply. And it's the only way that the Israelis can carry on with any of their wars, their war in Gaza, their war in Lebanon, and particularly their war in Iran. And Israel brags about this. The Ministry of Defense official who's in charge of this says, at any given moment, cargo aircraft and ships are en route to Israel carrying thousands of tons of munitions and military equipment. This is the core of our military strategy, he said. And the ships have been coming in daily, many times a day, air bridge, and also unloading massive ships. And there you see the Hemets. We watched those get destroyed last week on the show. So they get destroyed by the resistance, and the United States resupplies them to the tune of tens of billions of dollars to allow the war to continue. So this has been the resistance report for day 944 of Israel's genocide in Gaza.
Wow. Just, I don't know. I mean, it's pretty interesting that even these like ad hoc measures that the Israeli army is trying to develop to stop these drones are being met with even more
they knock it right out as soon as it's set up. They knock it out, and you know that they're laughing about that, because the Israelis are panicked. I mean, you read their internal reports, their army radio reports. They don't have an answer to these, especially the fiber optic guided ones.
Yeah. I mean, they were so sure of themselves that they had defeated Hezbollah, since last year. And they can't stop these little tiny affordable drones. Incredible. All right. Thank you so much, John. Does anyone have any other questions, comments for John after that resistance report? Anyone? Bueller?
Well,
okay, good. You did cover it all.
you covered it all, and none of this is being reflected in the mainstream media, and that's what's so remarkable to me. We are not seeing these images and this analysis.
Yeah. No kidding. The context, the coverage would have such a different tone if they dared to talk about how people were defending themselves against this, maniacal settler colony.
Imagine we had those floor-to-ceiling video screens that they have that they would walk all around. If they were showing these with a map beside it, and they wouldn't dare.
Al Jazeera is showing this now to Arabic-speaking audiences. I haven't been watching as much since the Iran ceasefire, but in general, they have toned down the coverage considerably. So people are being kept in the dark, and without independent media, without your analysis, John, a lot of people would not see any of this.
Yeah. Thanks again, John. Asa, you have an update on the Palestine Action latest court chaos that's happening. I mean, in the news report at the beginning of the show, I talked about the flotilla and the activists who were seized and detained, abducted by Israeli forces in international waters. But people who are acting in defense of Palestinians from inside the UK and trying to stop literally the war machine from operating at these factories are still up against major legal battles. So give us a sense of what's been happening and the updates in the Filton 6 case.
Yeah, that's right, Nora. Well, even protesters and journalists are facing persecution through the courts, really, in this country. So certainly Palestine Action is a prime target. Well, after more than 15 hours of deliberation, a jury here in the UK on Tuesday found two Palestine Action activists not guilty of criminal damage and four others guilty of criminal damage. So it was a partial not guilty, two not guilties and four guilties. The jury also found one of the group, the so-called Filton Six, guilty of grievous bodily harm without intent. The silver lining there is that it was a lesser conviction than the one of grievous bodily harm with intent that the government prosecutors had sought. That was Sam Corner, who was accused of injuring a police officer who had been attacking one of his comrades. The case was a highly politicized retrial of aspects of the Filton Six trial earlier this year, which I reported on in this article and we covered at the time from February. The six activists were accused of breaking into an Israeli arms factory in August 2024, and they were the first of a total of 24 defendants to face trials relating to the invasion and smashing up of a factory in Filton near Bristol in the west of England, which is owned by a subsidiary of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. In February this year, all six were found not guilty of aggravated burglary, the most serious charge, and that could have led to life sentences. So this retrial wasn't on that. They were found not guilty. But that jury at the first trial also failed to reach verdicts on some of the lesser charges, giving room for government prosecutors to seek this retrial. A highly fraught media and government led public atmosphere in the UK has been seeking to denigrate Palestine Action falsely as a terrorist group. In that context, the Crown Prosecution Service, the government prosecutors, brought these charges again, the ones that the first trial had failed to reach a verdict on, despite how in most other similar cases, the CPS would most likely have taken the loss from the February trial and moved on. Even more extraordinarily, the Filton Six have been treated as terrorists. I am actually, I've got to be careful what I say here, because I'm actually prevented by the British government, the British systems, the British regime, you could say, the British regime's press reporting restrictions from giving too much more detail than that. But other overseas media, especially the Grey Zone, has done a good job of explaining the details of that. But what I can tell you is that the 18 other defendants accused of planning the Filton Action were rounded up by Britain's counter-terrorism police in a series of violent pre-dawn raids between August 2024 and July 2025. Five of the Filton Six were released on bail in February after the not guilty verdicts on the most serious charges. Sam Corner remained locked up on remand. The three remaining defendants who have now been convicted of criminal damage have been returned to prison now, pending sentencing on the 12th of June. The media hype around so-called terrorism seems likely to lead to tough sentences. Factor in also that last year, Britain's then Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, actually banned Palestine Action as a quote-unquote terrorist group. That ban was ruled unlawful by the High Court in February, as I reported in this article. High Court overturns Palestine Action ban. A panel of judges at the time found that the ban resulted in, quote, very significant interferences with the right to freedom of speech and the right to freedom of assembly, end of quote. But the ban stayed in place pending a government appeal to the Court of Appeals, which has now been heard, and a verdict on that is expected soon. In the Filton Six retrial this week, for their closing speeches, all the defendants except for Sam Corner, who was on remand due to the GBH charge, asked for their barristers, their in-court lawyers in the British legal system, to step back. They gave their closing speeches themselves. Five of the Filton Six gave their closing speeches themselves. They did this due to the restrictions placed on their lawyers by the court system, something I'll come back to. But first, I want to read out almost in full the powerful closing statement of Zoe Rogers, the Filton Six prisoner, one of the Filton Six prisoners who spent more than a year on remand before being released on bail in February, and who has now been acquitted. One of the two who were acquitted on Tuesday. You can go to the Rebel Media website to Rebel Media has been doing a really good job of following the Palestine Action arrests and trials closely. And you can read all six closing speeches in full on their website, realmedia.press. Here's Zoe's speech. As you've probably noticed, I decided to represent myself in this trial, not because my barrister was doing a good job or anything. We've actually become close friends, and I'm constantly telling the others I have the best barrister. I'm so grateful for everything she's done for me in this trial and the last. But this time, I wanted to be able to speak to you myself. During this trial, you've heard some very important evidence. You've heard that there are factories on British soil making weapons to send to Israel. You've heard that the drones they make include Thor VTOL quadcopters used to drop grenades, drones that are advertised as battle-tested on Palestinians. You've heard that drones use AI to target children, and that Magni X surveillance drones work in tandem with killer drones, and that research and development carried out in the UK is vital to the Israeli military. You've also heard that the Filton site was opened by the Israeli ambassador, that it has export licenses to Israel, that Elbit itself is the backbone of the Israeli military. You heard how we tried every democratic means available to us, including demonstrations, fundraisers, encampments, petitions, writing to MPs, stickers leading to Amnesty International information about the apartheid, vigils, arms factory pickets. The list goes on. And how none of it worked. You heard how direct action is effective, how it ended apartheid during the civil rights movement in America, how it is being used in the UK today to shut down weapons factories, four of which have been closed permanently. You've heard that after we destroyed those drones, we were arrested for terrorism, were held incommunicado, spent 18 months in prison without trial. You've heard that this is a retrial. After hearing the six of us give evidence, you might think it odd that what's happening in Palestine has gone completely unmentioned. You might have noticed certain words that have been blacklisted, that until our closing speeches, the word genocide wasn't said once. There have been interruptions from the prosecution, quick subject changes from our barristers. It's almost as if whole topics of conversation have been banned. The prosecution know full well that we are right, that this factory is supplying weapons to Israel to be used in Gaza. That is why they're choosing to suppress it rather than contest it. The prosecution have decided that the legality of Israel's actions is irrelevant in this trial because they know you could not, in good conscience, find us guilty of anything if you are allowed to hear the whole truth. To find us guilty of criminal damage, you have to be sure. You might recognize the term beyond reasonable doubt. It's the same thing. The prosecution have to make you sure for you to be able to convict, but how can you be sure when you know you haven't heard the whole truth? Now, I'm an ordinary person with friends, family, a place at university, a cat I love. Basically, a whole lot to lose by going to prison. But you know that we all actually intended to be arrested on the 6th of August. We intended to go to trial, and I won't speak for the others here, but the reason I was willing and confident enough to allow that was because I knew that now, 20 months in the future, I would be standing in front of 12 ordinary people like you, not politicians, not legal experts, not barristers and judges wearing 400-year-old horsehair on their heads, but a panel of my equals. You're the best counterweight to power and tyranny within the legal system as it exists today. It is a privilege to be judged by you. And I don't say that to flatter you, but because, as you've already heard, the right to trial by jury is under threat, with a bill passing through the House of Commons as I speak. Juries, as we know them today, may not be around for much longer, precisely because your pockets cannot be weighed down by bribes from the rich and powerful. And also because juries often refuse to convict in these kinds of cases. And that is a very powerful position for you to be in. No one can tell you to convict in this case, not even the judge. In fact, The judge is explicitly not allowed to tell you to convict. You and only you can decide on your verdicts. But not only can you acquit us, you have the right to acquit us. No one can punish you for your decision. No one can even ask you why. I want you to know, however, that whatever you decide, I will not hold it against you. How can I, when you have been kept so in the dark? But you can be sure of one thing. I am proud. I am so proud that I took part in this. I am proud that I overcame my fear and took action. Because, of course, I was scared. You don't just break into an Israeli weapons factory for fun. And I can say with absolute certainty that this is the best thing I have ever done. Because there is a good chance that because of our actions that night, innocent lives were saved. And so I will never be ashamed that I was on trial, that I have spent 18 months in prison, that I may face many more. You know that we have been treated as terrorists throughout this process. A domestic violence worker, two nursery school teachers, one Oxford graduate, and an artist, and me. It sounds dystopian, but it's true, just like the prescription of Palestine Action. But this time, you are the decision makers. And like what the prosecution and the government want you to be, you are not a rubber stamp. Don't fall into their trap. Find the six of us not guilty of criminal damage. So that was the closing speech of Palestine Action campaigner Zoe Rogers at her retrial for criminal damage this week. Once again, you can read it and the other five closing speeches in full on the Real Media website, realmedia.press. Now, I'll finally say one more thing. Press restrictions were lifted this week, revealing the existence of the government's prosecution of Rajiv Menon, a leading human rights barrister who's facing contempt of court proceedings after he was accused of defying a judge's orders during a trial of Palestine Action activists. You can read about that in this article in The Guardian. Now, that trial was the Filton Six first trial in February. Menon informed the jury of their right to acquit according to their conscience, which is currently established and enshrined in British law. The Guardian reports that the proceedings are believed to be the first brought against a barrister in respect of a jury speech in living memory, possibly ever. So this is just one of many ways in which the courts have been, and the legal system have been, stitched up against Palestine Action, and that the British government is actually changing the rules and changing the laws in order to protect Israel and its genocidal regime in all ways.
Thank you, Asa. God, that speech by Zoe Rogers is just
really good, eh?
It's so moving. So moving.
Yeah. And so truthful. Yeah. Can you imagine any of our leaders in the West speaking so truthfully? It's impossible to imagine.
They'd never. Yeah.
Well, she's, you know, as I said, she was acquitted. So, you know, maybe yeah. we could get her on the stream at some point.
Yeah,
that would be amazing. And, yeah. You know, they have acted with such courage, and they're inspiring others to take similar action. Jumping ahead to the website, we have another story that people should read about activists in Germany who are facing trial for smashing up an Elbit plant in Germany, in the city of Ulm. So they're being referred to as the Ulm Five, and they are being treated with similar brutality by German authorities, being treated as terrorists. And this is it now. This is it across the so-called democratic West. Yeah. War criminals are welcomed, given the red carpet. Weapons, peaceful factories are turned to weapons factories. Israeli weapons factories are treated as important institutions that have to be protected. And citizens who oppose these horrors are subjected to criminalization and persecution. So it's important for people to know about these cases and to speak out in support of these people who are putting their freedom on the line in defense of basic human decency.
Yeah.
No kidding. All right. Well, we're going to, of course, keep our eyes on the Palestine Action and related community groups who are trying to stop Europe's complicity in this genocide, of course. Let's go back to the website, actually, and take a look at some of the features that we've published in the last week or so. I read from two during the news report, Malik Hijazi's really important report about medicine shortages across Gaza. And of course, you know, in the report, it points out, of course, that this is not a new phenomenon, that this has been nearly a 20-year blockade now on Gaza, and the pharmacies are struggling to keep up with demand, especially now that 2.5 years into a genocide, people are injured, chronic diseases are entrenched, and there are no basic supplies to treat people because the entire hospital, you know, medical system has been collapsed and destroyed by Israel. So do give that a read. Also, Lubna Ahmed Abu Sitta's feature, of course, When I Leave My House, I Fear I May Never See My Family Again. Ali, you and Tamara published an extensive report on the new report by Euromed Human Rights Monitor that covers the systematic sexual torture happening in Israeli prisons.
Yeah, we had that really difficult but important conversation on last week's program with Meha Hosseini of Euromed about the horrific findings. And if you haven't seen that interview, and you know, again, there is a warning at the beginning because it's quite the material is quite disturbing. But if you do want to watch it, it's embedded in this article, and Tamara and I highlight the main points of this report in the article. So hasn't been covered at all in the mainstream media. And so that's important. And then there's a couple of other stories on the website that are worth reading. They're all worth reading in my opinion. Or we wouldn't work so hard to put them up there. The piece by Qasem Walid al-Farra in Gaza is very moving. It's just about the reality that transport in Gaza is so difficult. There are so few working vehicles, so little fuel available. And so what it's like just trying to travel from place to place. And he says we've become a nation of walkers. Everyone has to walk for many, many miles to get places. So a very lyrical and beautiful piece about a very difficult reality for people in Gaza. We have our colleague David Cronin, who digs deep into an Israel lobby group called EU Watch, which is based in Brussels, which is behind the campaign to demonize Rima Hassan, a French Euro MP, of Palestinian background, who is facing all sorts of persecution and smears in France. Again, part of the Europe-wide crackdown on anyone who speaks out against the genocide. And there's also a piece, a couple of other pieces from our colleagues, Ellie Gerzon's piece about last week's show, highlighting. If you missed John's resistance report, you're going to want to go back and read Ellie's piece and watch last week's segments, because it's sort of part one of the part two you got today, and on sort of the revolutionary significance of the first person view drones that Hezbollah is using with such effect in Lebanon. So lots of good stuff.
Yes, absolutely, as always. And of course, sign up for our email updates right there at electronicintifada.net. You can also hit the Donate Now button to become a sustainer of this publication. And Ali, I know we have some people we want to thank this week specifically for helping keep this publication alive and vital.
Yeah, I want to thank everyone who has donated to support our work, who continues to do so, particularly our monthly donors, because they are there week in, week out. They give us predictability, stability. They let us focus on doing the work, focus on working with our writers in Gaza and supporting them. They give us the time and space to do the kind of investigative work that we do. Everything you see on this show is supported by them. Excuse me, I'm going to drink some water.
A water break. I know, I'm just coming out of a cold myself, so
stay hydrated.
It's really important.
I try to, and you know, then sometimes that just happens. I think it's also spring.
Yeah,
finally spring is here. We have a little bit of spring allergies in the air. So let me just say a few, just thank a few of our monthly donors. We really appreciate your support, Claudia, Nadine, Saeed, Donald, Deborah, Anise, Milton, Farouk, Saikat, Carol, Abdurrahman, and Rachel. And of course, we have many people who just give a one-time donation once in a while. That's perfectly fine too. We appreciate your support any way you want to give it. So I'm going to say thank you to Gary, Bina, Salma, Jeannie, Fatima, and Hanin. Thank you so much for all your support, and to everyone else, we truly couldn't do it without you. And to everyone else out there, we thank you, we love you, and we appreciate everything you do to keep us going.
Indeed. Thank you, Ali. Thank you, everyone. Of course, I want to thank Tamara Nassar, our director and producer, Ellie Gerzon, who produces social media for us, Pierre Loisel, who produces the radio program that comes out of this, every one of our colleagues at the Electronic Intifada, all of our contributors, and on behalf of Tamara, John, Asa, and Ali, thank you all, and we will see you next week. Thank you.